production out of those incinerators. I think I got through your series of questions.
Uh-oh. What happens to the mounds of boiling debris?
Gone. At the end, when I said finish, I mean gone. Okay? No liquid waste, no solid waste. We think we'll have that done at the end of, pardon me, not September, the end of October. We're not going to only use the barges. The barges help us get rid of some of the backlog. We will continue to use the shredding and compacting facility to get that job done.
Will you continue sending some of it south?
Yes. Okay. I'm sorry, I couldn't see you behind the bright light over there. Now, that was the end of the winter program. I'm not going to talk about the winter program anymore. I'm now going to move over and talk about how do we get from where we are to the wintertime program. And it's what we call the transition phase. And the primary driver in understanding what we're going to do and how we're going to do it is talking about weather. And what's I want to spend the next few charts here with you, giving you some ideas about the weather that we're looking at. And these charts are in your package, but basically, as far as looking at our operation, through the summer, we've had low wind, gentle seas. That's kind of typified the summer weather, which has allowed fairly continual operations. We have been shut down by weather occasionally, but our weather experience in summer months, forgetting April, has been a little better than we anticipated. What happens to us now is we're beginning to move into an area where we have small craft warnings. Small craft warnings are a problem to us because most of our people move in small craft. They move to the shoreline, they move from vessel to vessel, they move to other kind of work vessels, they come back and forth in small craft. So when we have a small craft warning, then we're in a position where we have a safety problem for the movement of people. So that is a problem. And of course the other factor is storm warnings. And of course storm warnings get you into conditions, excessive storms get you into conditions where it's unsafe for those kind of operations. Now, to translate that into something that is just a little more meaningful, what we've done is array a few photographs of, if my cord's long enough, a few photographs of the type of equipment that we're talking about here. Small craft. We move a lot of people around on craft that look like this, and if you've been out there in our fleet, you know we have every variety of little boat that you can think of out there. And they tend to be small craft, and they haul people or equipment or small things around. But you basically got to get people onto these and off of these. And these include small landing craft that we use for that. Those, of course, cannot operate in severe conditions. This is one of our berthing vessels, the Columbia. And you've probably either been at or seen the Columbia or its sister ship, the Corinthian. And if you just look at the photograph, they look alike. And you noticed a couple of things about this. One, low freeboard. Second is windows at this low level. You notice this is not a ship that's designed for severe seas. It's an excursion ship. Now, it's been very useful to us because it got to us quickly. It's just not a ship that you keep out under storm conditions. So it becomes one of the ships we have to release early for safety considerations. You've heard us talk about, and you've been able to see, omnibarges in action. And you can just look at an omnibarge and know by definition, it is a shallow water, flat bottom device designed to get on the shoreline. If it had a lot of draft, it wouldn't work at all for us. So these things tend to be very weather susceptible. But more than that, look at the combination. Look at the stuff that we've got on one of those barges. And you know that equipment cannot take wave slamming. We didn't design it for that. It's designed for fair weather operation, if you will. So basically, that unit, which is the heart of our work unit right there right now, is not designed to stay out under severe weather conditions. And if you let me look at one more that's over on this side, this is a berthing vessel. And this is an interesting one because the barge on which this one sits is an ocean-going barge. That's a high-quality barge. But on the top of that, you've seen we've located trailer units, if you will, ADCO-type units, put them on top. It's the combination of those things that's not seaworthy. You can't protect people or equipment under weather conditions with that. So the barge is a very seaworthy vessel. The combination is weather restricted. Let's talk about a little bit of this weather. We're going to first look at some Prince William Sound weather, and then we'll look at some Yes, ma'am. You are right, and you're going to get them in just a minute. Stay with me. We're going to get there. I'm just kind of walking you up to it, if you will. I don't want to try to give you all the details of the weather. I would just tell you, first of all, these top two charts are NOAA. They come out of the climatic atlas of NOAA's. These bottom two charts come out of the National Weather Service. This is observed wind speed. This is observed wave heights. The thing to note off of these is the rapid change that occurs in September and August. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at wind or waves, you see that phenomenon. It's a remarkable phenomenon, how rapidly it changes. That's 10 years of average data on this. The bottom two charts from the National Weather Service come with just 4 years of data. This is forecast data. One of the problems we have in this area is there are not a lot of weather stations around that actually give you real data. We're talking about an area where there's not a lot of that. So what we've done, we've gone back and incorporated the weather forecast, which are updated every 12 hours based on what's going on. We have then used all that data from those 12-hour forecasts for 4 years. And what this describes is a probability of getting a storm of over 40 knots. Again, the thing that you note out of it is the rapid increase, or the rapid change in those kind of probabilities that occurs in August and September. There's another little phenomenon to look at, which helps just another statistical way of thinking about weather data. These are the days between small craft warnings in Prince William Sound. You get to talk about those regularly, don't you, Pat? And actually, when you get out of this period of time, the average days between, this is 4 years worth of data, is one day. Okay? And that kind of drops from a level that's up here. Again, what you're seeing is the sharp change in weather patterns that occur over September and August. Now, if you'll show the next set of charts, we've got four charts on the Kodiak. We've blown them up a little just so that they're easier to read for you. Again, we're just portraying the same data. It's from the National Weather Service, arrayed in a slightly different fashion. Right here, this is the risk of forecast wind speeds. This is the 25% probability of such a wind speed occurring. And on August the 15th, you have a 25% probability of a 61-knot wind. By September the 15th, that increases to a 25% probability of an 85-knot wind. Again, representing the sharp change in weather patterns that occurs over a relatively short period of time. You see the same phenomena that occurs in wave heights. You know, on the 15th of August, you have a 25% probability, this is in the Kodiak area, of a wave of 28 feet. Not that that's a small wave. I don't want to belittle that that's a significant wave. But that has increased by the time you get September the 15th to 34 feet. Again, sharp change in weather, significant deterioration. Risk of a 40-knot wind, and again, what you see on here are some different areas. That's Northwest Gulf of Alaska, Kodiak and Barren Islands, Kodiak and Southwest Gulf of Alaska, and Chelyakov Straits. But the same kind of upward pattern, significant increase in probability of severe storm events August and September. Days between observed wave heights. Now, this is a different area. This is Middleton Island data, which happens to have a weather station on it, one of those few spots around that has some weather data. So this is hard data, if you will, harder data than the other. Now what this says is that at the 1st of September, pardon me, the 1st of August, there are about 10 days between observations of 10-foot waves that occur at that point, about 10 days. By the time you reach the middle of September, that's dropped to 1 to 2 days. 1 to 2 days between observed wave heights of 10 feet or greater. Now, where that's important to you is a number of our vessels have to transship out of this area down to Seattle or Ketchikan or back to the Gulf of Mexico for a few of the vessels. So they're going south, so they have to traverse that area. So that becomes another important part of the weather forecast. We've had this team that's been working on this for some time now. Part of their planning effort is showing you a distribution of the major vessels. And this is a chart that's in your package that you'll be able to see. But basically, some of the vessels are leaving, going out to the Gulf Coast, some to California, some to Oregon, some to Washington, some into the Juneau area, and to other parts of Alaska. The interesting feature off of this chart, and this was a bit of data that we didn't know until we actually calculated, is how many of the major types of vessels are going to return to an Alaskan home port or elected to remain in Alaska. And you'll see that that's 45% of the tugs, 35% of the barges, and 45% of the other major vessels. Of course, about 95% of the fishing vessels, the small vessels, are Alaskan in the first place and return to Alaskan ports. So within Alaska, there is a major portion of the work vessels that we're using now that will be here through the wintertime. And I'm very pleased about that, because that says there's some high accessibility of those vessels for future activity if needed.
Is there a way to stay, or you said some are remaining in Alaska?
Some are making that option. Private, guess, opinion. There'll be a couple of them that'll bet on the come. You always have a few guys who are going to do that. A good number of them are returning to an Alaskan home port. Now, our planners that had put this plan together, they take all of that weather data, they take the home port destination, they study the vessel, and then they decide on a date that vessel needs to leave, that it needs to leave to go to another place. But that isn't the end of the problem. What we've got to do is work on what we call a typical minimum time to prepare for departure. Once you say, I want a vessel to sail from Hinchinbrook on a given date, you've got to get it ready. What this is the get ready chart. And it describes the things we have to do to get a vessel ready. We've got to clean these vessels. We have to dismantle these vessels. Some of them have to be inspected. Some of them have to be put on other vessels for transport. And the time to do that ranges from 3 days to 10 days, depending on the size of the vessel, what it has on it, what it takes to get that job done. So whether, as you would expect, the 10 days tends to be the maxi barge, where you have to take an omniboom off, or you have to take heaters off, or you have to take the fuel tanks off, all of that equipment to come off. They take a little longer time to dismantle than it does to take to dismantle a landing craft, which has less equipment on it, a little simpler device. So they vary, and of course, the small craft, which are primarily the fishing boat fleet, they may just have radio and gear and cleaning to take off of those. So that's a fairly short time. So this goes into the planning process for each vessel. So you take the safety date and you back up, and then you get a date for which that unit stops working. Now this chart, somebody asked that question. You asked that question a minute ago. This chart shows when do the vessels leave. In other words, when do they leave the Kodiak waters or the Prince William Sound waters for the key vessels? And what we've shown you on here is kind of a bar chart, you know, which has a curve, something like that. The bulk of the vessels are leaving in the week of September the 15th and September the 22nd. But they start in August, and there's still some that we're winding out of the system at the 1st of November. It depends on the vessel. Depends on what the safety consideration is for that vessel, how it ties in. Yes, ma'am?
Examples of some vessels that might be there until November 1st.
We have some large berthing vessels that can also serve as work platforms. And let me give you an example. The DB-100, if you've seen it out there, it's a large semi-submersible that we're using for a quarters facility. That vessel could sit out there all winter long. You couldn't do anything with it because nothing could get to it. You couldn't service it, and you have a few problems like that. But as far as that vessel itself being anchored in the middle of the sound, yeah, we can take care of that vessel. It is a seaworthy vessel that will stay during the winter. So consequently, you don't turn loose of that vessel until it's through with its work cycle. It's not driven by safety consideration. It's driven by when are you out of work. So those tail-end vessels that are over here are not safety driven. And in fact, what you can say is coming from this direction, the program tends to be safety driven by vessel. If you come off of this size, you really optimize it based on remaining work.
As far as cleaning the boats, then from what I understand, there's some boat cleaning stations that are being escalated now because they're sending out some more barges to do some more cleaning. How would you clean those vessels towards the end, towards November? I mean, where would they
be? Oh, they'll probably be cleaned before then. Okay. But they may remain in work even though they have been cleaned at that point. So we'll have, is it total 15 boat cleaning stations? Is that the right number, Bill? We'll have 15 boat cleaning stations located around so that boats don't have too big a queue to go through to get that done. And it will take care of each one. But these on the tail end will probably be cleaned before that time. Remember, some of the boat cleaning sites are in harbor protected areas that are not out in the open water areas.
Is your reduction in the number of boats out there start to affect the amount of effort you're able to put into?
We're coming. Okay, going to get there. All right, let's try this one. Just so you have a feel for what goes on to get you to these kind of decisions, you don't get at these kind of boat safety decisions lightly. And we've got 14 or 15 people involved, and this gives you an idea of some of the expertise that you've got. Naval architecture and marine engineering, oceanographic data, marine surveys, tow hydrodynamics, and then of course we've had marine safety, and that comes out of the Coast Guard connection that we've got. And they've come from a number of contractors as well as our own research organization. So we've had a fairly extensive team of experts looking at each vessel, deciding what that configuration was. Our objective was to have a plan that would allow us, if work justified, to keep each vessel as long as possible under safety considerations. And remember that progress chart that I showed you earlier, I told you it was safety driven. So we were keeping each work vessel in there as long as I could from a safety standpoint. And we were describing the rest of the time available to those vessels as time for retreatment if we need to do retreatment. Now let me show you one more, which helps address a part of the question that was asked, and we'll have to come to another chart to finish addressing that. This curve right here is the last date for safe voyage to home port. In other words, that's the departure date, if you will. This curve, offset to the left, is the last day in active work service, if you will. And you see it shifted this way to take into account whatever that cleanup or preparation is we need to be able to sail that out of the harbor. So consequently, to answer the question of when do things stop working, you have to look at this data. To know when do things leave the port area for their home port, you look at this data. So you have two different sets of data. Now what I'm going to do is show you some data that's related to this curve. I'm going to show you some data on when things stop working, in other words. And I've got two charts that show you some of this data. Again, looking at primary vessels, Prince William Sound, Prince William Sound, Prince William Sound, Gulf of Alaska. Landing craft. Some of our very, very early landing craft we found is basically more susceptible to weather than we thought it would. Some of them are small, and so consequently some of those have to go out a little earlier, and that says when do they come down. Now, there are three kinds of vessels we've noted in landing craft. Hot water, and what you notice is the hot water tends to stretch out a little longer. One is we tended to put them on later and on some of the better landing craft so they can stay longer. So consequently, we keep a lot of the productivity in the system, and these down at the bottom are the Batmobiles. They're the stuff that are putting on the bioremediation treatment. Again, we put those on some of the better quality landing craft, so they tend to stay closer to the end. These are when these vessels come out of service based on safety consideration. Not the date they sail out, but the day they come out of service. Same philosophy occurs on maxi barges. Remember we described early, we had 26 of those. This is where they are. You'll notice we stay at 20 out to about that point, and then they start coming down. The omni barges, in general, tend to be on a little better barge than the maxi barge. Not totally, but you remember we built the omni barges a little later. built the maxi barges first with what we could get in here first, those of you that have lived with us through that building cycle. So you see that reflected a little bit in when the barges have to come off the line right here for safety considerations. Berthing vessels, we've described some of these out here to you, such as the Columbia. Now what we did in berthing vessels, and because you'll see our berthing capacity stays very high, is we knew about 10 days or so ago that this was going to occur as the data came out of the study. So we asked the Coast Guard to send in a replacement for the Ogden, which was scheduled to leave in early August, and the Duluth is replacing the Ogden. So what we've done is we've bumped up our berthing capacity by keeping a Navy ship in here much longer than we anticipated we would need to do, and the Coast Guard and the Navy have agreed to do that. So consequently, these are brought down then in order of seaworthiness of the berthing vessels. Those that are out here at the very end are the ones that I just described, like the DB-100, that are not weather sensitive. They really get sensitive on how long can you keep support craft to work around those. Gulf of Alaska has a combination of fishing vessels and tender operations and some landing craft, and they tend to come off, but they tend to generally be smaller, so they come off on a little sharper curve. They tend to run out there and fall off on a sharper curve. We have detailed schedules for each major vessel in the operation. Some of those are going out in convoys. We have convoy names and dates as put together by that team of experts that we just showed to you. Now, to give you one last feel for how that wraps up, this looks at personnel and equipment with a couple of things on this chart. This shows people, and this is basically, this is support. These are the people that were on the beach that we showed you on an earlier chart, Prince William Sound, Gulf of Alaska. What you see here is basically the people that are on the beach are phased out by the middle of September. There are still 3,000 people on the payroll at that time that are in that phase-out process because we have so long for taking vessels out. And these are the 6 task force groups that operate in Prince William Sound. And we put this on the bottom to give you an idea of as the vessels change and the people change, how does that happen? So this is how the task forces continue to work through that period of time. Task forces will reconfigure. Bill will take the vessels that have to sail. If he has to take down a task force, when he does, he will reconfigure what's left that can stay. So that he'll continue to take maximum operating capability out of the vessels that remain within the task force through the safe time that is available. So this schedule for bringing down the task force groups is based on the same safety consideration that you saw with each individual vessel. This manpower then follows that equipment capability. We keep all the manpower on location to operate that equipment safely. As needed through that period of time. And as you know, while there's a transition, it doesn't suddenly stop and move to one thing. But what we're saying is we then move over to the winter program. Now, if you remember some of the things I told you about the winter program, field data collection, contingency response, community liaison, science program, coordination activities, continuation of these committee meetings, and this mapping and data management. So, No. These 3,000 are continuing to dismantle vessels, clean vessels. Basically, over here in the winter program operation is about 300 people.
Where did this chart come in? On the date September 15th, there's nobody out there cleaning out the occupied
up there. Answer that's no and yes. Okay? Which one you want first, the no or the yes answer?
Yes.
Okay? let me tell you. For the conditions under which these task forces operated, okay, those operations shut down. Now, I described to you under the winter program some arrangements that we were going to attempt to make with the communities, which would continue some things such as monitoring and some tarball pickup and some of those activities which could safely be done. Some of those occur under this program, but they occur under the conditions and the safety considerations that I've described to you for the winter program, and not out of this function right here. So it's a different kind of effort, but it doesn't say Whoops, I was bound to step on that one time. It doesn't say the effort is zero. It does say the effort is under a different program, it's a different scale, slightly different objectives, but there is an ongoing effort.
And as I look at this chart...
Excuse me, I've got a guy back here in the back who hadn't gotten to ask a question yet.
Overall, are you pleased? I mean, there's been a lot of charts and a lot of graphs. Overall, is Exxon pleased with the way things have gone, you know, since March 24th, and will there be this kind of effort again in 1990?
Well, of course, I don't know what it's going to look like in 1990. I've described a fantastic science program to you to say what we're going to try to learn for next spring. But I have to honestly tell you, I don't know what it's going to look like next spring. I've described to you the facilities, equipment, and manpower that we have within Alaska, which I think are significant in their own right. What we're going to need, again, I don't know for sure. Our capabilities to do things will be high, but I don't know what it is we're going to have to do. I'm not ducking your question. I'm just saying I don't know how to answer it. I don't know how to technically answer it or to give you an operational answer for a work function that I can't yet define. I have been able to describe for you the people, the capability, the equipment that we do have for the wintertime and the kind of studies and analysis that we will be doing. And I think that's as far as I can take you at this time because that's all I know.
When does Exxon expect to have an idea if they're coming
at? You'll find in the written material that you've got that we propose in the second half of March to submit to the Coast Guard a spring plan. Okay? You always have to have a plan, right? And we've asked them to approve that as early as possible in April. That's our recommendation to them. As you know, we just presented that this morning. They haven't responded to that. So I'll be able to tell you a little more when I get a firm answer on whether they approve this plan. But that would be, we think that's a reasonable going forward target.
Realistically, do you expect that you will need, that Exxon will need to come back and do just a little bit more work next spring? I mean, is that the...
I don't know. I honestly do not know. I do think that the data that we're gathering, the monitoring that we're doing, the people that we have on site, we're going to be able to answer that for you come spring. At this moment, I don't think there's anybody that I know of that could give you a firm answer to that.
Looking at the chart here, the first day is Monday, and the next day is the 27th, which is the following Monday when the...
Charles, help me. Which chart are you looking at?
Sorry, this one right here.
Okay.
So I guess that means that they're going to start laying people off next week. Is that right?
You're saying from here to here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if laying off is the right way to do it. Let me tell you, there are a couple of ways you can handle it. You know, we run people on a rotating cycle. Our contractor runs people on a rotating cycle. What you probably do is you don't bring... When people go off on that R&R cycle, they don't come back. And I suspect that's the primary way that they'll step down. We've actually been, if you noticed on an earlier chart, our total manpower count is down a little bit right now. And there's a reason for that. We've quit building maxi barges and omni barges and putting heaters on landing craft. We've finished the mobilization phase. So on our total manpower, we don't have this big construction crew on shore. So as Pat's probably aware, out at the man camp that we've got 150, 200 spare beds right now, where we had that thing chock-a-block at that time, full up, and we were overflowing people to everything that we could put people into around town. Right now we've got spare because we're not building. So, you know, what you got to do with that is kind of look at what is the work effort at a given time, you know, and say what's that benchmark, and then I can describe to you what's going on around it.
Well, is it fair to say that this phase demobilization begins next week?
Transition, if you want to. And I've already told you, I don't know how to give you a date. You could say it started today when I shipped those five containers with surplus equipment. Or you can say that it ends on November the 1st. And I don't know which of those dates that you pick in between there. It is a period of time. You know that chart that had the departure date for vessels? It is something that occurs over this span of time over which we I don't know, maybe the start date was whenever I rented the warehouse space in Anchorage. Okay. But it is a period of time over which those events occur.
If the Coast Guard and the DEC were overseeing you in this project, they don't like it. It doesn't give them much time to make recommendations to change the plan. You think the plan maybe should have been prepared a little bit earlier?
Time available. We've been working hard on this plan. I don't want to tell you that this plan came lightly or easily. You know, whenever you decide on how you're going to handle 1,700 container loads of equipment, how you're going to bring 1,300 boats out of the fleet, how you're going to get 7,000 people off of the water, that is not an easy plan. And I don't know of any way we could have come up with a meaningful plan any faster. We started that plan before we had completed mobilization. We were still in the final mobilization phases when we kicked that plan off. You know, and I don't know how I could have started that study much earlier. And you've seen the kind of experts that we had involved in that kind of work to go through that. I don't think it could have been done much faster. But to go back on your question, we were a little surprised when the experts got to us that there were a few vessels that had to go out that early. And consequently, that's why we went to the Coast Guard to give ourselves some coverage on berthing vessels by adding the Duluth into the fleet. So we think we've covered ourselves. So we think we've given them enough time to evaluate it. I think it's a plan that really answers the requirements that the Coast Guard and the state have asked for. I think it's a good plan. You would expect me to think that, though, wouldn't you?
Well, I had an inkling of that. I noticed the Task Force 6 is going to be going out this week. When did Task Force 6 come on? It seems to be it wasn't that long ago.
I can't give you a date, but let me tell you, it's not quite a germane question, okay? And let me tell you why. Although we defined it by task force, what happens is there are some vessels that have to go. Okay, Bill Rainey then incorporates that in his optimization of how do I use my workforces. Am I better keeping 6 skinny task forces, or am I better in keeping 5 that have a little more capability? And that's not an easy optimization. I don't want to belittle that, because you got to tie that into your work schedule. Where do you need to have vessels? When do they need to be working? What do they got to do? So that loop has been tied in each time. So the question, it really gets tied to these vessels that had to go for safety reasons. Bill did the optimization step. Each time another group went out, he did another optimization step that allowed him to do the maximum amount of work in the time available. And that's how that went. Whether it was Task Force 6 or Task Force 1 or 5 or 2 wasn't really critical. It was the work program that he was laying out. So it could have been, you know, under some circumstances, could have been another task force.
Also, I'm curious about the whole business with the corrective compound. Three different times in the whole process, we come up with a corrective used by your company, and each of them rejected being inadequate. I guess my question is, does this mean that we have no dispersant compound or any surfactant compound to fight future oil spills? And I'm curious why we waited until 1989, considering the movement of oil out of this port, to start looking around for these compounds to do these jobs. Why weren't they incorporated in the 1974-76 oil contingency plan?
Well, there are a lot of questions there, Pat. Let me tell you, I can't answer the contingency plan questions. You know, I'm not an expert on what the contingency plans were here or where that was. Let me just tell you, the Corexit 9580 that we're talking about is not a dispersant. Dispersant questions and beach cleaning questions are different questions. Well, let me tell you what it is not. It is not a dispersant. In fact, one of the characteristics of this compound, which make it useful for beach cleaning, is that it is a lousy dispersant. It tends to make the oil get on top of the water instead of dispersing it, which makes it good for beach cleaning, and that when you wash it off, anything to do with the dispersant contingency plan issues. Now, why is this one so late in being formulated? This one was really formulated for these beach conditions. It's a modification of a chemical that's been around for a while. but modified to specifically apply to these beach conditions, the aging condition of the oil that we have. It's unique to this application. I'm not telling you that I know where else you could apply this. You know, it is useful for this one. It fits what we have to do. I don't know it'll fit anywhere else. And I'm not sure that you may not. This is not a scientific opinion because I haven't thought about this, so this is off the top of my head. I'm not sure that it may not be necessary to consider for beach cleaning that there's probably some modification at each unique site. You know, you might luck into one that's off the shelf, but if the conditions are unique, and I think these are unique, you may well have to do some design on the spot to fit those conditions.
But the end result, Otto, apparently is that for the Coast Guard, who has the ultimate hammer in this, we still do not have a dispersant nor a surfactant to be applied to future oil spills at Prince William Sound.
I am very hopeful, optimistic, maybe unreasonably optimistic, but I'm at least very hopeful that the scientific community that's involved with this, with the data that we presented last night, will arrive at a new position on 9580. We've already told you my position. It does clean much more effectively. It is visibly cleaner when you stand on the beaches. It is markedly more efficient, and it is environmentally safe. So I think that maybe with a new program that we presented and the new data that we presented, there may be a new position for this application. But I sure wouldn't want to extrapolate this application to any other one. I'd say it's for this application.
Well, you still, I'm sorry to keep hammering away at this. I'm reading the puzzle now. The contingency plan of 1974, which I read, calls for dispersant unspecified. Dispersant was used earlier on, was rejected. You know, second dispersant was brought up or rejected also. We'll even talk about the surfactant. So we're back now to square one where dispersant's called for in a future oil spill. We do not have an approved dispersant. I'm still curious why we're at this stage, 15 years after the port opens, and we still don't have an approved dispersant for future oil spills.
I really don't know the answer. I haven't read the contingency plan myself, and so I'm really not the right guy to answer that. We can get someone to talk to you about that.
Sure.
Somehow
about
that. Yes, sir.
As far as the treated beaches go, does Exxon believe that they're as clean as they can possibly get, or would you retreat them if you had more time, or do you think that winter storms might help out?
Well, let's see. That's a series of questions, so let me start at the back end of that, as I recall them, if you will, and you can help me if I miss one. I think undoubtedly the winter storms will be of help. Our objective that on getting beaches treated or environmentally stable is to have the beaches in condition so that they do not harm otters, seals, bird, or the normal flora and fauna that live at that site, and so that subsistence hunting and fishing and commercial fishing can go on unrestricted. That's our objective in treating beaches. If you want to ask me if we think we're going to reach that objective, that is the plans that I have laid out for you right there is what I think will do that, if we're able to get all of that done in the time frame that remains to us. But I don't think we need to get into the how clean is clean debate. You've kind of got my definition, and I don't think it's an answer that we can probably resolve here.
DEC seems to fear that winter storms might wash up subsurface oil and leave it in the water, perhaps in a state where it could be skimmed. But you seem to think that it will wash up subsurface oil and disperse it.
I'm saying I don't know, and that's why we have a contingency force. And you'll notice that our contingency force in Valdez has one major vessel with skimming capabilities, both major vessels with snare boom capability, and through the 1st of November, we're keeping a third major vessel here so that we could even respond further if needed. So the answer is I don't know what will happen in those major storms. We are providing some contingent capability that could follow up if those events did occur.
That's the call-up force.
That's the boats that are online, if you will, and the boats don't really need labor to be able to scatter snare boom, but if they had to do significant more work, I'm saying labor other than the boat crew. But if they had to do significant more work than that, you would have to have call-up people.
How many people are on the call-up list?
Haven't made it yet. it'll be enough to get the job done, and I don't know how many that is. We'll have a sufficient call-up list. I don't think that's going to be a limit to us. You know, we got a workforce that had over 10,000 people in it. I think we'll be able to generate a pretty good call-up list. Yes, sir.
Could you describe for us how you intend to move about 7,000 people through Valdez, mechanics and that, if you will?
Well, first of all, they won't all move through Valdez. Some of the people will move out through Valdez. Some will move out through Whittier. Some will move out through Seward. And, of course, some will come out of Kodiak. Maybe even some come out of Homer. There is a plan. Okay. Excuse me. Let me wrap this one up. There is a plan that's laid out for those. The objective for the cities involved, to answer that kind of question, is people don't overnight. It's kind of an army discharge system. You come in, you know, you get cleared off the payroll, you get your final check, you get a medical if you need that, you get on a bus and you go, or a train. The two clearing points will be the facility that's here in Valdez and the one that's in Anchorage. Obviously, if you go through Whittier, Seward, Homer, you'll clear out in Anchorage.
You say get a medical if you need that. Why is that a prerequisite?
Some people will decide, you know, we can't force people to take medicals. We will have a medical staff available if someone wants to have something looked at.
Given they're in a chaotic health condition.
They're not a chaotic health condition task force. They're very good, nor are we dealing with hazardous materials. Yes, ma'am.
As far as maintaining your facilities here through the winter in Valdez, are you anticipating people to shovel off snow off the trailers?
Yes.
How many people?
Don't know. How many people does it take to shovel snow off 72 trailers?
Is that a FECO determination or an Exxon?
Oh, no. We'll determine. We'll arrange with a local contractor, a local Valdez contractor, to do that. But I don't know how many people it takes to shovel 30 feet of snow. Okay. Thank you very much. I appreciate all your attention. We appreciate all of you taking time to be here today. And hope we've been able to give you some useful information.